This is the time of year when vegetable gardeners are usually thinking, do I really have to wait until next week to plant my tomatoes? This year, there is no question. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be here. We'll talk about this strange May snowstorm that has affected most of the state, and we'll find out what this weather means for your yard and garden. We'll also talk hostas with hosta fanatic Dick Gladden, associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. And, of course, Richard and Dick will be here to answer your questions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. We'll be taking your questions in a few minutes, but we're going to start the hour by talking about hostas and this crazy weather. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is here. Good morning, Richard. Good morning. And Dick Gladden, associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, is also here. Hi, Dick. Hello. Can you hear?
We're having some technical problems, Charity.
All right. Well,
we're
going to
fix it, though.
Okay.
You know, I almost blurted out Merry Christmas, but you know.
A lovely snowy morning, or at least slushy morning in Ames?
Yes, it is.
Oh, dear. I've seen a lot of pictures from Central Iowa. In Iowa City, I don't want to gloat. We're just getting horrible, icky, cold rain.
Well, yeah, right. We got the white stuff.
Right. And I was just looking out the window here at our studios in Iowa City, and our red bud trees in the parking lot are in full bloom now. Mm-hmm. And it made me think about all those beautiful red bud trees on the Iowa State University campus that must be covered in snow.
Actually, they're not quite blooming yet. I think they will be by next week. Just a few things are blooming right now in Ames, things like some of the magnolias, forsythias, some of the early things like plums, but the crab apples, the red buds, they're still in the bud stage. They should be perfectly fine.
Oh, good. And the things that are blooming, what will happen to them, do you think?
Well, I think the biggest concern for me has been the weight of the snow. It has kind of flattened some things like the tulips and daffodils. It hasn't broken them or destroyed them, but it has kind of pushed them over. And some of the branches on some of the trees and shrubs are drooping quite a bit. And so we might have some minor branch damage, but most of your perennials, like your daylilies and your hostas and your peonies, are up and growing. They're covered in snow. They should be perfectly fine, I think. So.
All right. So
it's not as grim as we might think.
Right. Well, it's not good for anybody's mood,
no,
I'm sure.
It's not.
But so probably not a lot of permanent damage done.
Probably not. And as far as the fruit trees, we haven't had temperatures that would damage the fruit trees like our apples and cherries. You have to have temperatures of 28 degrees or below to really damage those. And we've had temperatures around 32, 33. So even though it's snowing, we haven't had the temperatures that would actually damage them.
All right. And even if there is snow sitting on the branches, on what are about to be the blossoms on these fruit trees, that's not going to be a problem?
That's okay, as long as we don't have any breakage of the actual branches on the tree.
All right. And as I mentioned in the billboard, we are a week away from traditional tomato planting time. Do you think that this is going to slow things down?
Actually, I would be inclined to go out and actually buy my things this weekend, as far as at a greenhouse or garden center, and harden those outside for a few days, may plant next weekend. So, and I'm hoping we're going to be okay.
All right.
But by next,
we were jubilant last week because we thought spring had finally arrived.
Yes, we did.
it's got to come soon.
But I think by next weekend, this may be a distant memory. So.
All right.
I'm hoping.
All right. Well, as we mentioned before, the hostas are already up. And Dick, Richard tells me you are a hosta fanatic.
Well, one might consider that, yes.
What kind of collection do you have?
In my yard, I have about 500 clumps and about 350 different species and cultivars.
350 different species and cultivars?
Yes.
I didn't even know there were that many.
Oh, yes. There, a book was published several years ago by one of the leading authorities in the area of hosta and hosta breeding. The name of the book, if I can put in a little plug for it, it was sure. Not me that wrote the book, but it's called The Hostapedia, and it's available through a number of sources. And as of a couple of years ago, the Hostapedia was the catalog for all of the species and cultivars of hosta, and it contains 7,400 entries.
Wow.
So there's 7,400 plus species and cultivars, and in the time since that was published, we've actually added about 400 to 500 more species and cultivars, and so we're beginning to approach 8,000 different species and cultivars of hosta. And this book is a really, really good resource for any individual who has great interest in the area of hosta. It's quite inexpensive. It's only about $79 plus shipping for a copy of it.
And for a deep hosta fanatic, that probably sounds like a good deal.
That's a pittance for some of the hosta fanatics that I know of in the state.
So I see hostas everywhere I go. They seem to be something that is a very popular part of public landscapes, outside of buildings, and, of course, in many yards as well. What makes hostas so good for a land, or so good as a landscaping plant?
The hosta is very good for several reasons. It grows in a wide range of conditions, from cool, wet conditions to sunny and drier conditions. If you keep two major principles in mind when you're selecting a place in which to put it, one of the primary considerations is the sun exposure, and typically we group the hosta cultivars into about three distinct areas of sun exposure. And then and I'll come back to that in just a little bit. And another very, very important aspect of it is making sure that you keep the root zone area cool and evenly moist. And these two things, a proper sun exposure and a cool, moist, consistently moist root zone, will allow hostas to be growing very vigorously, very finely for many, many years. And this makes it a very low-maintenance perennial plant.
And how long do they live?
Hostas will live for very, very long times unless something such as a fungal disease or bacterial disease or virus will strike them. What typically happens on a really long-term one is that the center dies out. And this is not at all uncommon in a number of perennial species, that as they get 8, 10, 12, 15 years old, that the growing point is on the outside edge. It kind of looks like a donut, and the center part will die out, but it's this ever-increasing donut ring that keeps growing and growing, and if you then dig that up, divide that, it'll keep regenerating itself. And there are many, many species of hostas that have been around for years and years and years.
So you can almost keep it going indefinitely then?
Essentially, yes, you can keep it going indefinitely. However, if you don't divide it at some point, you'll end up with this donut type of an effect, which would not look good in your garden to see this blank area in the middle of it. And so I typically will recommend to people I talk to who ask me that question that I suggest to them that about every 5 to 10 years they would look at dividing it, even if it's only to lift the root zone clump out of the ground and taking a spade, just simply cutting it into four and then replanting one of that in the original hole, and then either giving away or planting someplace else the other three quarters of the clump.
I remember Richard saying on previous shows that you need to be wary of accepting some of those divided clumps from other people. What are the dangers that you can pose to your hosta collection by bringing in plants from the outside?
One of the first ones is that unless you get it from a very, very reputable source that takes great care and attention to detail, you can end up with a mislabeled species, and you end up propagating, and they end up propagating, and everybody ends up propagating an incorrect plant. And people often want to know what the particular type of hosta is that you have. And the same thing, you have the same issue with other perennials too. If you don't know what it is that you're dividing, then you can run into problems with not having the correct material. You tell somebody it's this cultivar when actually it was a different cultivar. And so that's one issue with it. A number of people don't really care that that's an issue. They just want that perennial, and they're okay with it, even if it did not have the correct name. But the other things that you're vulnerable to are bringing in diseases with somebody's division that maybe they were having troubles with it. They decided to divide it, and it looks like it's good at a certain point of the year, but actually it's carrying some form of a virus or fungal disease or bacterial disease. And then you end up inoculating your yard, and sometimes the fungal or bacterial or viral species is not very host-specific, and it can end up on other materials that are in your yard.
What do you do with so many hostas in your collection? What do you do to keep the slugs off of them?
One of the best treatments is a home treatment with it, and that is a 50-50 mixture of vinegar, just typical 3% vinegar that you buy in the grocery store, equal parts mixture of that and water, and put it into a spray bottle, and then go out either late in the evening or early in the morning when the slugs are still around, and just simply spray the slugs that are visible, spray them with this mixture, and it's pretty gruesome for the slug, but basically this causes the slug to shrink up, and then you end up with very, very low. You end up with very low concentrations of the slugs.
Okay. Well, we will talk more hostas in a moment. Dick Gladden is here with me, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist. And this is for everybody in central and northern and western Iowa that's been shoveling this week. This is Talk of Iowa.
He sings a love song as we go along, walking in the winter wonderland. In the meadow we can build a snowman, then pretend that he is Parson Brown. He'll say, are you married? We'll say, no, man.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa. With me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, Dick Gladden. You're welcome to join us with your questions. We've been talking about hostas, but of course, Richard and Dick will answer your questions about anything in your yard or garden. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can post your question on our Facebook page, or you can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And again, that phone number is 866-780-9100. And Dick, Richard tells me that when he gets stumped, and Richard Duran, from my personal experience, very rarely gets stumped, but when he gets stumped, he actually turns to you to help him answer his questions.
Yes, I do.
That's amazing. So there... I can't imagine there's anything we can't handle today.
Well, there's lots of things I don't know. There are lots of things I don't know, but it just so happens that I guess when Richard comes to see me, I usually know it's something that's really, really off the wall or takes a little bit more science approach to answering the question. And so, yes, Richard does come and visit me every once in a while.
All right. Well, we will get to some questions right now. Again, 866-780-9100. This is an email from Marion. She says, I recently purchased a Sterling Linden tree as a shade tree with the bonus of flowers and fragrance. The tree has not yet been delivered. A friend told me that linden trees on her college campus years ago had an obnoxious odor. Because of the smell from linden trees, have I made a purchase that I'm likely to regret?
Now, it typically blooms in June.
And Alyssa, I think you've got the wrong mic on for Richard. Can I hear you now, Richard?
Okay.
There you are. Great.
The linden typically blooms in June, and the flowers aren't terribly attractive. They're kind of a creamy white color, but it does have a very strong fragrance, and most people think it's pleasant. Now, if you stand right near the tree and maybe stick your nose in a flower, it might be a little bit overpowering, but if you have one, let's say, near the back porch or patio, I think it's a very pleasant fragrance.
All right. So, Marion, you're probably okay. Let's do another email question before we move to the phones. This is from Eric in Davenport. I have a leggy yew, not sure of the exact species, that's getting very top-heavy. At about 10 to 12 feet tall, the bottom third of each main trunk or stem is fairly bare. Two-part question, is there a way to encourage growth on these bare areas, or will this bush need to be regenerated by cutting back to the ground? And then he also asks, is it too late to prune this year?
Well, the yew is an evergreen that you can prune fairly severely. Most evergreens, if you prune them severely, they will not come back. They simply don't have the ability to initiate new growth from bare limbs, but a yew has that ability. So you could do it fairly severely, probably wouldn't cut it back to the ground. As far as doing it at this time of year, that would be a good time.
Okay, but there's no way to encourage growth on the lower part without cutting it back?
You would have to cut it back really severely to get growth near the base. So you'd probably have to cut it back to within maybe a foot or two of the ground to get some growth at the base. Because otherwise, if you, let's say, pruned off maybe a foot or two near the top, you would get some new growth near the top.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Ray is on the line in Mason City. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What's your question?
I looked at my daffodils this year, and they're still spreading out. But I had one flower. Last year, I had 23.
Okay.
Was that affected by the drought?
No, I don't think so. But there's a couple of things that you have to have as far as for the daffodils to do well. First, you have to have a well-drained soil.
Mm-hmm.
You also need to have a site that receives at least 6 hours of direct sun. Okay. Because when they're done blooming, that foliage will persist for like 4 to 6 weeks. And during that 4 to 6 week period, the foliage is manufacturing food and then storing the food back in the bulb. And they have to store a certain amount of food in the bulb in order to bloom the following spring. So they need plenty of sun. And the final thing is that you should not cut back the foliage until it dies back naturally. Okay? So as long as it's green, it should stay. When it turns totally brown, you can cut it off. So basically make sure it's a well-drained soil. Make sure it gets plenty of sun. And don't cut the foliage back until it dies back naturally.
Well, it seemed like I've been doing that.
Okay.
I just had a few plants, like 4 or 5 the first year, the second year, it doubled. And
right.
And been growing. But all of a sudden, this year, down to one.
No, typically, if you have a favorable site, if they receive good care, that clump will get bigger and bigger, and you get more and more blooms. And the clump can stay there for 15, 20 years or more. Now,
okay.
If you think the clumps are real, real dense, what you could do is once the foliage dies back this spring or early summer, you could dig up those clumps, okay, and then separate them and replant them and make sure you have a well-drained soil and plenty of sun, and they should be okay.
Okay, how far apart should you put the clumps?
I would say the bulbs should be planted about 6 inches apart, and the actual bulbs should be planted 6 to 8 inches deep. And if you replant those later on this year, they may not bloom a whole lot next year, but if they have a favorable site, they should increase in vigor and then bloom the following spring.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, Ray, thanks a lot for your call. And Lee in Iowa City actually has a related question. Hi, Lee.
Yes.
Hi, you had no blooms on your daffodils this year either.
Right, and I'm sorry I missed the answer that he just gave, because when I was talking to you, I didn't really hear what. But I've been told sometimes it's because they're overcrowded, but these haven't even been in place that long, you know, and I have other clumps that are bigger than the ones that are coming up. They shoot leaves, but no flowers.
Okay. Well, again, make sure it's a well-drained soil. They get plenty of sun.
They're on a hill.
Okay.
Yeah.
At least 6 hours of direct sun each day, especially in May and June when you have the foliage present.
Yeah, they're on the south side of the house.
Okay. And don't cut the foliage back until it dies back naturally. Those are the things that typically we need to do.
And I never do. I never cut the foliage back because I have other perennials planted around them, so it sort of hides them when they. And I never braid them because I've seen people do that too.
Yeah, don't do that. That actually is counterproductive because when you do that, you actually have less of the leaf surface exposed to sunlight.
Right.
So don't do that.
Why do people do that?
They have to be perfect.
Okay.
I think of Martha Stewart when I think of that. Sorry. It takes a lot of time to do it, and it's counterproductive, so I wouldn't do it.
All right. Well, I don't know where that gets you, Lee. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I can't believe it's not a question of not enough fertilizer, and I don't believe they're crowded because, like I say, I have other clumps that religiously produce tons of flowers, and they're bigger clumps, actually, than the ones that aren't flowering.
No, if it's a good typical Iowa soil, as far as structure and fertility, it should be fine. Now, when you buy daffodils and tulips, make sure you buy them from a reliable company. Sometimes you can buy some where maybe they're seconds, or maybe they weren't stored properly, or maybe they have a disease. And so you want to make sure you buy them from a good, reliable company.
Yeah, and then my other question was, I had a beautiful hosta collection, and it's like pretty much totally disappeared. And I know I have voles in the garden because they pretty much decimated all my oriental lilies and Asiatic lily bulbs. So my question, my other question was, will voles eat the roots of hostas? Because they've just pretty much all disappeared.
The disappearance of your hostas could be, there could be a number of different things that could be causing their demise, and voles are one of them. Voles will eat a lot of underground structures as their food, and the crown, what's called the crown tissue, is the overwintering storage structure for hostas. And hosta actually, when the leaves come up in the spring, it uses most of the underground storage structure that was there previously. That'll get used to get the plant up for this year, and shortly after the leaves get up and get expanded, very much like a bulb material, a bulb like the daffodils we've been talking about, the leaves photosynthesize and send new carbohydrates and other things back down into the storage structure under the ground, and it begins to store this. And actually, you know, you would know this. If you then had a rabbit come by and mow down your hosta, if you just simply will add some water, keep watering that, be faithful to the fact that that plant will survive, often what will happen is it'll resprout. Mm-hmm. And what's happened is the rabbit has mowed that top off, and then what it does is it reorganizes this underground storage structure, and new sets of hostas will come up from that. And actually, that is a technique that's used for production, commercial production of hostas, instead of having 10,000 rabbits in the field, what they do is use a lawnmower. And commercial, a lot of people don't understand this, but a lot of commercial hostas are grown in fields in full sun. And then when the hosta comes up in the spring, after a certain point, the commercial grower will go in and mow them off completely, feed them really well with a good dose of several good doses of fertilizer, and keep them well watered, and they will multiply and pop back up again. And then after a certain period of time, they run the lawnmower over it again, and they'll do this typically two or three times a year, and each time they're doubling to tripling the amount of plant material they have down there. And then in the fall, they will dig that up and cut it up into a number of different pieces then that they then sell the next year as bare root material.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that, and that underground storage structure can be eaten by a number of other things like voles and so on and so forth. We'll use that as a food source. In addition, what you can't eliminate is that other fungal diseases and so on are not getting getting the plant material from the top. There is a fungal disease that is has been researched by Dr. Mark Gleason in our plant pathology department here. He had a number of grants from the American Hosta Growers Societies and so on. And they found that this fungus, the fungus is much more prevalent in the South, but it also has spread to certain places up here and has created issues in certain people's hosta collections where the fungus has gotten in and then gradually spread through. The overwintering structure of this looks like little prills of fertilizer. And so I would go back and look at your hostas and see if at the base of it, where the petioles are coming out of the ground, if you have little tiny spheres or balls at the base of the plant, you may have this disease that strikes hostas. Okay, but if you know you have voles already in there, I'd say that that's a pretty good candidate for the cause for why you're losing your hostas.
All right, Lee, good luck with that. We've got another hosta question next. This is Pat on the line in Mount Vernon. Hi, Pat.
Oh, hi, Charity.
Hi, what's your question?
I've got a collection of hostas, and one of my friends said that I have a virus in one of them, and I wondered, how can you tell for sure that you have the virus, and then how do you deal with it if you have it?
If the most prevalent hosta virus is called Hosta Virus X, and if you do have that, what I would suggest that you do immediately is, once you have a diagnosis of it, that's what it is, that you dig that plant out and get as much of the roots and everything as you can, and get that either burned or into trash. And get it away from the rest of your materials.
And how can he get a diagnosis?
I think what that person can do is dig up part of that clump, put it in a plastic bag, and send that to the Iowa State University Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. And they have the ability, there's a test that they can run very quickly and detect the presence of a virus. So they can do that. There's a $20 fee. They can bring the sample to the county extension office, and they'll forward that on to Iowa State.
Okay, so he needs to send a sample to the Iowa State University Plant and Diagnostic Clinic. All right, Pat, good luck with that. And our next caller, Charlotte, has the same problem as a lot of people do with hostas, and that's that they're so delicious. Hi, Charlotte. Charlotte, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, so you have problems with deer eating your hostas?
Yes, and I want to know if there's any way I can discourage them.
I have heard of so many absolutely positive cures for it that when I tell somebody about such and such a cure for it, They'll do it, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And my suggestion to you is that the best cure is to put up about a 4-foot-high fence around your thing, because many of these things work and many of them also do not work. Okay. One thing I can tell you is that that deer and other animals that roam around, like bunnies as an example, rabbits as an example, really, really love the hostas that are green and not very heavily coated with wax. If you will look at this and you look at areas where deer and rabbits have visited, they often will do all of the hostas that do not have a very heavy wax coating on them, and then they'll leave behind the ones that do have a heavy wax coating. And that is typically associated with our blue-leaved hostas. The actual leaf of the hosta is green, but the blue color that we see in these particular cultivars is due to a wax coating, and that wax coating is not very delicious to the bunnies and to the deer, and so they typically will stay away from that, those blue cultivars.
Okay, so plant less tasty hostas and or put up a fence. Charlotte, thank you so much for your call, and we're going to take a short break. We'll get back to more questions in a moment. You can join us at 866-780-9100 or send your email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Dick Gladden, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Dick Gladden, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. And let's go back to the phones. Andrea is on the line next in Ankeny. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I've moved into a new neighborhood and a new yard, and I'm kind of starting from scratch zero, and I've got some problem areas in my yard. I have two young boys, and I'm trying to make the yard friendly for them. I've got some thistle, I guess I could just call them thistles, that are growing really low to the ground, and I'm trying to figure out how to get rid of those. And then the other one is a tree that I've been told that is a lotus. It's got long pods on it, and they have very long thorns that come off of them. Do you have suggestions for me?
Okay. There are a number of different thistles, and some, like the Canada thistle, are very, very hard to destroy because they have this enormous underground root system, and you have to destroy the whole thing. One possibility would be to maybe take some Roundup and pour it into a small container, and then get a small foam-type paintbrush, dip it into the Roundup, and then dab it on the thistles very carefully. And do that repeatedly as long as it keeps on coming up. And if it is something like Canada thistle, this could go on for a year or two, possibly. Okay, but be persistent. Be persistent. It's going to require persistence and patience. As far as the tree, is it a tree actually?
Oh, just a moment. There was a little noise on the line. Is it a tree? Is that... Oh, I'm sorry. Hang on. I'm having technical problems because I'm confused. So hold on, Andrea. There you go. You're there now.
Okay. Yes, they're small trees, and I feel comfortable with maybe getting my family to cut them down, but I just want to know the right way to go about that, because I noticed that the pods are sprouting, and those little baby sprouts are quite dangerous also.
Because the honey locust is a native tree to Iowa.
Okay.
And the honey locust has these big, maybe 2 or 3 inch long, very sharp pointed thorns. Very, very nasty.
Yes.
They also produce these maybe 6, 7, 8 inch long pods.
Yes.
Fairly thin, but fairly long. And that's the native honey locust. The ones that we plant in our yards typically do not have thorns. They're thornless. They also do not bear fruit. So we have no thorns, no fruit. So do you have a honey locust in your yard?
Yes,
a mature
I have the
tree.
Thorns and the pods.
On this tree?
Yes.
Well, I guess the question would be keep it or get rid of it as far as remove the tree.
Okay.
Because,
do I need to worry about the root system on that then?
Absolutely. Because if you cut the tree down, the root system is still alive. It's going to send up a huge number of sprouts in the yard.
Would you suggest me just getting a landscape or a tree business to help me?
What I would do if you don't want the tree is I would cut it down.
Okay.
But leave like a foot tall stub or stump.
Okay.
And as soon as you have the tree cut down, take your Roundup again and your paintbrush and apply the Roundup to the area just below the bark. Just below the bark. Go all the way around it. Okay?
Okay.
And then maybe come back in 2 or 3 weeks and cut off another inch or two of the stump.
Okay.
Do the same thing. Okay? And then every time you do that, more and more of the Roundup goes down into the root system, and hopefully that should destroy it, and you won't get these sprouts coming up. Otherwise, if you don't do that, you will get many, many sprouts.
I think it sounds like I'm going to maybe get some stock in Roundup.
Well, no, you're not going to use that much. You're not actually going to use...
Oh, oops. Sorry.
So, in this case, the Roundup is very useful. In this case, it really is.
With the thistles, though, when they're just growing now, and as she mentioned, they're very low to the ground, can she just dig them up, or will the root system be so deep that they'll just come right back?
Yeah, digging is just very, very difficult, because if it is a Canada thistle, they may go down a foot or two, and digging them up, getting maybe 4 or 6 inches, just doesn't accomplish much, really. They could try, but if they go that route, they're going to have to do that repeatedly over time also.
All right. Well, Andrea, good luck with that. Let's go next to Cindy on the line in West Des Moines. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I live on an odd-shaped acre, but we're on a hill. And once you get past maybe 10 feet out our backyard, it slopes severely, and we're having a problem with erosion. Now, the problem on top of that is that our sand filter for our septic tank is there. So there are things that we can't put in, but I was told I can add maybe 3 or 4 inches of dirt on top of it to what's there. And I was wondering if there's something you could recommend that might help stabilize the hill.
I would think just a good stand of grass. Because if it's nice and thick and dense, that should stabilize the ground. You shouldn't have erosion. You'll have to mow it periodically, but mm-hmm. It does a very good job of stabilizing the soil. Grass does.
Okay.
And if you're going to do the grass planting, now is actually not the best time to establish grass. I would suggest strongly that you talk to one of your local garden centers, but actually what you should go do is in late August to early September is the best time of the year to establish a new lawn or a new portion of a lawn.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Cindy. And we've got lines open for your calls right now at 866-780-9100. Let's get to some of these email questions. This is from Christian in Shoeyville. I've got a lilac about 3 feet high that needs to be moved. How late can I transplant the little guy?
Most are starting to break bud, but I think if they try doing this, it's fairly small, only 3 foot tall. If they can maybe do this late next week or next weekend, they might get by with it. But just dig it up with a nice bowl of dirt around it, move it, and replant it immediately. Keep it well watered. Should be okay.
All right. And this one is from Marlene. I have an iris bed that is being taken over by chives. I have dug the chive bulbs out around the iris, but some of them are too close to the plant to dig. Is there any herbicide that I could put on the chives without hurting the iris?
I think in this case, what I'd probably do is dig them up around midsummer, like in July, and maybe put them in pots or whatever, where I can keep them for a few weeks or months, and then methodically try to dig up and destroy the chives.
You know, in our garden, we have chives, and they were there because of the people who lived in
right.
our house before, and we don't use them for much. So we have completely neglected them. We have tilled them under. We have done nothing to them, and they come up every single year.
Yes.
And I told my daughter the other day that chives are indestructible, so she wrote that on the sidewalk. And but this seems to also be true.
Very prolific. Yes, they are.
All right. Let's go now to an email from Earl. My trillium are up and blooming. Will there be damage from the snow or cold temperatures?
I don't think so. Again, they can handle temperatures in the upper 20s. Most perennials can. And these are native plants. This does happen in Iowa on occasion. And so they've adapted. They'll be okay.
All right. Marianne in Des Moines says, I planted zinnia seeds over the recent lovely warm weekend with the snow and cold. Will they still come up? And if so, will they be delayed?
They'll probably come up. They'll be delayed. But my guess is if it warms up next week like it's supposed to, that they'll be okay. If it was to stay cold and wet for a prolonged period, I think the seed would rot. But if it warms up next week, should be fine.
All right. And next up from Gail, I understand that daffodil bulbs may not bloom if exposed to heat. Could last summer's weather have had an effect? My daffs also frumped this year. I love that term.
Boy, it shouldn't, because they typically go dormant. They die back usually by, and we had an early spring last year
mm-hmm.
too. So I'm guessing they were totally dormant by late June. And the worst of the drought was July, August of last year. So they wouldn't have experienced that. So it shouldn't have had much problem, because by late June, they were basically dormant. So
it's interesting, though. We're sensing a little bit of a trend.
We are. And I'm not sure the reason for it.
Right. Maybe if you keep getting calls on that on the Hort line, it might be something to investigate. Holly is on the line next from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Holly.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Yeah, winds is no going to go away. No. We have a Colorado blue spruce in the backyard, and it's like on the south side. Okay, back toward the end of winter, we had some really heavy-duty rain and some heavy-duty winds, and I stood there and watched our tree start falling over. And right now, it's kind of like at a, well, I'd say about a 45-degree angle. Now, it did not pull the roots completely out of the ground, but you can see them bulging.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've got it propped with two boards about midway up, because it's like about a 50-plus foot tall tree.
Ooh.
And I've put towels on those so it didn't dig into the thing. Now,
what's going to happen?
Possible.
What's going to happen to that tree if it falls over? Is it going to land on something?
Well, not really. It'll just slide right down beside the garage.
Okay.
But I'm wondering if I take, you know, like the plastic round tubing so it doesn't damage the trunk, and hook a come-along on it, if I can gradually, slowly pull that back up, or will this tree die?
Well, I think what's going to happen is we're going to get a storm, and it's going to get blown over completely, okay?
Because we were going to anchor it with, you know, in 3 points.
It is so big. If that is that big, it is so
big,
it's really not, I don't think, practical or feasible. And so I don't think that's a good option. Unfortunately, I think a storm at some point, either ice storm or wind storm, is simply going to push it back and totally destroy it. So it's sad. But I might be inclined to remove it just for that reason, because
we were debating.
Especially if it's going to fall on anything, it would come out, I think, immediately.
Yeah, it's falling to the west, and it's like, if it dropped, it would just barely crease the side of the garage wall. But it wouldn't damage it.
Okay.
But we also had gotten some of that really heavy wet snow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh my gosh, this tree is just, you know, because I know the roots grow really shallow.
Right, right.
So even pulling it back up and anchoring it would really not do a thing.
I think that would be hard to do if you have a strong thunderstorm and you have 50-mile-an-hour winds. I don't think that you can probably stabilize that tree. It's just there's so much force being put on it, it's probably not going to hold.
All right, so. Holly, sorry about that. Next up, Barb is on the line in Cambridge. Hi, Barb.
Yes, hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I have two apple trees left out of seven. And they've been here longer than I have been, which is about 26 years. I'm concerned about them. One, similar to the lady who just called in about 3 years ago when we had a very strong wind in the summer, one of them's leaning at about a 45-degree angle. Both of them, like the ones that I lost before, have gotten this grayish, I don't even know what to call it, on the bark.
Hmm.
Now, they still leaf out and blossom, lots and lots of blossoms, you know, every other year, like, you know, the typical two-year cycle,
mm-hmm.
and get good, you know, get apples, you know, but not always, you know, a whole lot of apples, depending on, you know, the season and the wind and all that. But I know that there are a lot of branches dying.
Okay.
And I just don't know. I want to save these trees, but I don't know what to do.
Well, I would prune out the dead limbs, get rid of those. As far as the brown material, that's probably lichens, which is a natural thing.
More gray.
Right. Lichens are kind of grayish in color oftentimes. They're part algae, part fungus. They're natural on trees and branches. Not a problem. But the fact you're seeing dead branches, that is a concern. That indicates the tree is declining. And I guess my inclination would be to go ahead maybe and plant another tree near the area to possibly replace the tree if I lose one. You could try possibly, since an apple tree is much smaller, you could try maybe pulling it back, anchoring it possibly. But I think I'd probably plant another tree just to make sure that if something happens, I still have my apple trees.
Okay. So is there anything I should do about the lichens?
Nope, not at all, because they're harmless. They're harmless.
Oh.
Yeah, they're totally harmless.
They seem to precede the dying of the branches that they're on.
Well, they are most numerous on dead limbs because they get more sunlight and moisture. But they're basically harmless. You'll see lichens on big boulders or rocks, on shingles on a house. They'll grow where nothing else can, but they take nothing from the plant itself.
All right, Barb, thanks a lot for your call. And one last hosta question for today, Dick. This is from Marilyn in Perry. She says, I have hostas coming up with that donut hole in the middle that your guest discussed. What time of year should I divide them?
Hostas should, first of all, hostas basically can be divided at any time of the year, if you need to. However, the best time of the year is right about now when the shoots are emerging and they look like little fingers sticking up out of the ground. And the big donut that I'm talking about, just simply cut it up in chunks. Now, and then you can divide that and then replant it. If you replant later with it, you make sure you mulch it very heavily because there's going to be a lot of water loss through the larger leaves, and you'd want to insure against that.
All right. Dick Gladden, thank you so much for being on the show today.
You're quite welcome.
Dick Gladden, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Alyssa Weiss. I'm Charity Nebbe. Monday on the show, we're going to talk about the challenges faced by interracial families. This is Talk of Iowa.